Hello, and you are listening to Eco Justice Radio on KPFK Los Angeles and KPFT Houston. A project of SoCal 350 Climate Action, our show presents environmental and climate stories from a social justice frame, featuring voices not necessarily heard on mainstream media. Welcome, I am Jessica Aldridge. On today's show, A Global Perspective on Permaculture Design, host Carrie Kim will be interviewing Warren Brush, co-founder of True Nature Design and Quell Springs Permaculture. Warren Brush is a global permaculture and resilience design consultant, educator, lecturer, and implementer. He has worked for over 30 years in agroecological education and regenerative system design for communities, private and public organizations, households, farms, and conservation properties worldwide. He is currently working on a variety of international resilience design and food security projects.
Aloha, this is Carrie Kim. Listeners, prepare for an inspiring conversation with Warren Brush of Quail Springs Permaculture and True Nature Design. We'll discuss the potential of regeneration with permaculture design from a global perspective. First, we want to thank the Tongva ancestors for their legacy and millennia of stewardship, for our show comes to you from their ancestral homelands. May our actions benefit the Tongva lineage and beyond. Humanity stands at the proverbial fork in the road where fateful and auspicious decisions are made. What human beings choose now may well determine the survival or extinction of our own species and that of many others. During the UN Climate Conference COP26 in Glasgow, China and the US pledged to work together to cut carbon emissions. Despite this news, more is required of us individually and collectively to change the status quo. Climate change, the pandemic, and our human-centric lifestyles are exacerbating poverty, global hunger, and ecosystem collapse. Climate refugees, losses in biodiversity and wildlife habitat all continue to mount. For many of us, regardless of where we live, access to water, soil, food, and shelter are not guaranteed. It is as sobering a time as it is one of great promise and potentiality. Thankfully, many around the globe are hearing the call of regenerative permaculture design and are ushering in a collaborative and sustainable future. We're grateful to have renowned permaculture designer Warren Brush here to contemplate the world as it might yet become. Welcome, Warren.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Such an honor to be able to have a conversation following such good words. So thank you for those words, because those are the words that we have to be speaking to one another and to our children for there to be future generations. So I'm so grateful. Yeah.
You have taught, served, and worked in agroecological education and regenerative system design for over three decades at different scales, from households to global communities. What initially compelled you upon this path?
Well, first, I just want to acknowledge that I'm speaking to you right now from Chumash land, which is north of the Tonga people. And I am very grateful to be here on this, the ancestral land of these people who still live and love and do ceremony on this place. So I wanted to acknowledge that first and foremost. And what inspired me, you know, I had a few different inspirations. One of them was very early on, and I was born in Pasadena in the mid 60s, and I had a great grandmother who was 90 years old in the 60s. So she was born in the 1870s, and she was very classically the little old lady from Pasadena. I'm sure she might have been the actual one, and she she had this incredible garden, and my parents worked and went to school at that point. And so I would go and spend time with her, and she raised chickens. She had so much of her food came from that backyard. And that was one of my first imprints of what it was like to live in the world, was that you grew a garden, and I have a belief that all the problems of the world could be solved in the garden. I really believe that. It's our relationship to that which sustains us. So that got me really going with that. And then we ended up moving up to the Santa Cruz Mountains, where these beautiful sequoias, the coastal redwoods and beautiful rivers that are there had an imprint on me. And permaculture is so much around natural patterns. And so I had a childhood that allowed me an incredible free roaming expression of play in and immersed within the beauty and the bounty and the immense diversity of nature. And that, I think, when you ask about what inspired me, that was kind of the crux of it. That just like really got me going. And then that led into later in life, my wife and I ran a wilderness program in Santa Barbara, which still runs today, called Wilderness Youth Project, teaching kids about their inner nature and finding their true nature through being in nature and immersed in nature. And we had a lot of kids coming out of that program saying, well, how do I live this ethic day to day? How do I tend to the land day to day? But I live in town. Many of the kids were in homeless shelters, and we were working with a lot of kids who were inner city kids who were going through a lot of difficulties. And so they would say, how do we do this day to day? And that was the birth of Quail Springs and my dive into permaculture.
Okay. Well, Quail Springs began in what year was that?
So that was 2003.
Okay.
And Wilderness Youth Project started in the mid-90s at a homeless shelter in Santa Barbara called Transition House. And we would take these kids out on the weekends and build debris huts and do fire by friction. And we'd go animal tracking. We'd like track cougars and bears and beavers. And we just had these incredible journeys. And the kids would come back to the shelter where their moms were mostly single moms. And they would say, Mom, we don't have to live here anymore. We can live in the woods in a debris hut, you know? Which was really, you know, it was one of those things of like, well, we can have a light footprint. And that really got me into this thought of like, what is my ecological footprint? And what is the ways that I can actually live now without stealing from my grandchildren and my great grandchildren? Absolutely. And that really stuck with me. And I've had some really good teachers in my life, including one of the founders of the permaculture movement, Bill Mollison, was one of my teachers as well.
You know, having been in this field for so long, I'm wondering how you would define permaculture from your own direct experience.
Yeah. Well, okay. So imagine you get into an elevator and you have one floor to go with somebody. You get in and you basically have to do that elevator speech. And so what I would tell someone, if they said, hey, what's permaculture? And the elevator starts moving up, I would say permaculture is a design science for regenerative human settlement. Ding, we're at the first floor. So it's, okay. You know, permaculture is a design science for regenerative human settlement. If we have another floor, then I talk about how that's based on natural patterns, working in harmony with nature. So the principles of permaculture are based on natural systems, you know, 3.8 billion years of research and development. And it's like whenever you push against a natural pattern, it costs you energy. So the whole idea of harmonizing your system to work with the natural energies makes so much sense. Is it harder to push a rock uphill or downhill? So you see, you can then look at every aspect of the design of your unique context of your own life and say, how am I working with nature? How am I pushing against it? And how is that costing me energy?
Yeah, it's something we see all the time, right, in the modern world or in the urban world. You've been traveling extensively around the globe, working on various projects. And I'm wondering if you can describe what a global perspective of permaculture design looks like.
So first, I kind of want to step back, because permaculture draws itself from observations in nature. It draws itself from indigenous wisdoms from around the world. It draws itself from appropriate technologies and biomimicry, and it looks at many different ways where people are doing things that are life-giving, and then has assembled it into a design framework. And so when I look at permaculture, the process has been going on since the beginning of humanity. I mean, we have always been designing to work within our landscapes. And I think what's so unique about permaculture is that it's now kind of reminding people that it's in our muscle memory, that this is something that is a part of our DNA, that we know how to live on the land in a way where we can steward it to be incredibly vibrant, and that this beautiful flowering earth that we live upon is something that we are a contributing factor to, not something degrading it. And that's something that I believe is just who we are. Our gift as a species is actually stewardship. Mm-hmm. And so when I step into looking around the globe, there are so many people who have been living in that way and still live that way now. And I want to acknowledge that permaculture is just this assemblage of ideas into a framework to help us who have damaged landscapes to redesign those damaged landscapes to be in a healing process. Because I also believe that for the human heart to heal, the landscape you live in has to be in a healing journey as well, because you're not separate from that landscape. Mm-hmm. And so I find a lot of the work that's happening globally is about healing the heart of the human, which I think is really interesting, by healing the damaged landscapes that we live within and that we have within us.
Goes hand in hand. What you had said, the journey of becoming fully human, and that is our relationship with the land.
Yeah. And that's how it's always been. And I feel that, you know, I get a lot of people coming to me and say, "Oh, Warren, I'm so disconnected from nature. I want to reconnect." And I'm like, "Oh, wow. If you ever think that you're disconnected from nature, you don't understand how much nature is around you and how you are immersed in it. Even if you're in the most urban setting and you are sitting in a high rise in New York City, you are still incredibly connected to the natural world around you." And to me is actually a heartwarming way of living. It's like remembering you can't extract yourself from the web of life. You just can't. And it's our amnesia that we carry within us, this modern amnesia, that actually draws us away from those connections and says, "Oh, we are not connected," or I've disconnected, but yet we're completely dependent on the natural world for everything that's in our life. Even the computer we're speaking through right now is, you know, there's tantalum from the Congo, and there's all these different parts of the natural world are in this computer. And we have to acknowledge that that's still a part of nature. And I think it's funny, when I go into a city, it used to be really hard for me after growing up in the woods, and I would go and I would get to this place where I had a hard time going into the city, until one of my elders in my life said, "You know, Warren, you have to remember the concrete is an ancient riverbed, and the forest is still there. And when you're walking through the city, is to remember to touch the concrete wall and say, 'I remember you, river. I remember you. You're here still.'" And it changed my relationship with metal and steel and airplanes and everything there, because they all have emerged from the natural world and have been enslaved into a technology that likely they didn't want to be. You know, it's like they've been enslaved into a non-natural way of being themselves. And so the more we can remember that, it also remember that that's also in us too. We have this modernity that has been put over us in our life and slammed down our throats of, this is the way you need to live. We have to build our GDP. You know, we've got to grow. Everything's about economy, which is just not a natural way of being. And I think sometimes we have to recognize in each other, wow, there's still this wild indigenous being that's in every single person, in hiding, likely. You know, most likely they're in hiding. You know?
Yeah, diamond in the rough.
So how do you create those conditions for, you know, those germination conditions for that indigenous part of ourself to have a home?
You know, do you think, you had mentioned in one video I'd watched of you, you had mentioned the grief You had mentioned, okay, we're not disconnected, and yet on some level, we do feel a certain disconnection, maybe from specifically the land where we might have sprung from just by our face, you know, by our heritage. Mm. We have certain connections to land that are different than other people. I mean, I'm Korean. I have a different connection to Korea than, say, you would just innately, and you might feel that, and you may not. But people will speak about this kind of grief of being sort of orphaned in the modern world. Many of us are immigrants here. We don't have that thread of connection with our indigenous ancestors. We may not speak the language. There's a lot of intergenerational sort of loss of culture and tradition. And that is a certain kind of a heartbreak that a lot of us may or may not have ever have addressed or even recognized. And what are your feelings about that? And are we destined to repeat some of the same sort of running? Let's talk about the, you know, the migration or the exodus from Europe to here and what they were escaping and fleeing to come here. So can you speak to that? Do we need to acknowledge that severance and then, you know, move forward?
Well, I mean, I think you just touched on the issue of our time. I think it is grief related. And I think there's a place back in our histories with everyone now. It's the syndrome that has traveled around the world that have knocked people off their indigenous root has affected every one of our ancestors and some people directly. I mean, it's still happening in the modern day, but it's definitely something that we all carry with us, I believe, is that we have this grief of at one point somewhere in our ancestral lineage, there was a point where we had emerged from a mountain, a sacred mountain in some place in the world, and our story was there, our creation stories were there, our cultures were there, where we were living intact with the landscape, where we were honoring the things that sustained us and all the origins of what sustained us in such a beautiful way. And that at some point, some syndrome hit those people, and you had this basically knocked off their indigenous route and people went into flight. And it's interesting, if you track it, it's gone westward. So there's this Western movement, but it literally is this one after another. You have the people who were recently knocked off their indigenous route going into the next layer of the next people west of them, knocking them off their indigenous route, and that syndrome carrying along where it's all in our hearts over time and through generations. And I feel like there's a real connection of that original grief that was there, this incredible grief of being separated from our ancestral land, that is a part of the syndrome that plays itself out with land degradation. And you see the land degradation going on globally, I think comes from that grief. I think it's part of how it expresses itself out. And that's a much longer conversation. Maybe over a 2-week call, we could talk about that. But I think it's an interesting thing to look at, because each one of us, I think, for us to take our next best step in living regeneratively in the world, there are two things we need to do. One of them is we need to research our own ancestry. We need to know as much as we can about the history of the places that our ancestors were from, the stories that are directly within our ancestry, or if you lose the thread of your bloodline, you at least follow the people back and find out where and what are the stories of those people. And then the second is the place you live, you understand the history of the place you live. And so you start to look at what are the indigenous tribes that have been there? What was the geology, the geological history, and then leading up to the people's history? And how is there near Quail Springs, there were some incredibly horrific massacres that took place in the valley there, near just down the road from where Quail Springs is on the Chumash people. And that's a part of the grief that's in that land. And I feel like for us to understand how to take the next best step, we have to do some of that grief work before we can take a step that's not carrying the grief unknowingly into the next steps we make.
The next steps in the next generation, you know, even as
exactly. They become ghosts, don't they? They become ghosts that transfer from generation to generation. And there's a lot on all of our shoulders now, because a lot of this work and grief work hasn't been done by a lot of generations for a lot of us. And so this is where we have to stop running. And we have to root into the ground, and we have to weep for those tears that were never wept by our ancestors. And it's something we have to create the space and the support for in our work right now. And I think it goes, you know, the work I'm doing in a lot of refugee camps in Africa, it is so much around how do you grieve, but then in that process, how do you help the land heal as you're doing this? Because
stay in the grief, but the grief is also a vehicle. So Warren, we're going to take a short break right here, and then we'll come right back and continue.
Hey listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying Eco Justice Radio. We air every Friday at 3 p.m. on KPFK Los Angeles and every Monday at 9 a.m. on KPFT Houston. Stay connected with us by subscribing to Eco Justice Radio on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, to check out previous shows and guests and get connected with us on social media. Today, you are listening to A Global Perspective on Permaculture Design with host Carrie Kim and guest Warren Brush, co-founder of the True Nature Design and Quail Springs Permaculture.
As of right now, the UN agency, the World Food Program, has mentioned that there's 41 million people, as of June 2021, 41 million people in 43 countries teetering on the very edge of famine. And many of the countries you know are in Africa. Not all, but there's Ethiopia, Madagascar, South Sudan, Yemen, Nigeria, Burkina Faso. And Warren, I know you were spending a lot of time in Africa. You had said you've already made 5 visits there this year alone. And I wonder if you could speak to what is happening there and our global impact and also the global possibilities right now.
Oh, thank you for asking that question. It's, you know, Africa is a big place. Each country, each district in each country, each tribe and each area has its own different story. And so I've seen places of devastation where so much of the Western influence has actually caused entire areas of stable ecologies that have supported people for thousands of years have been wiped out for sugarcane production that's being promoted by Western companies. And they pay off the government there as part of a scheme to build their income where they're poor people who only make a dollar a day. But those people who are called poor have all their housing. They know how to make their housing. They've been growing their own food and harvesting their own food for thousands of years without any intervention or any food aid. They've got good, healthy, clean water. They've got a beautiful elder culture. They have much of their intact culture was there, but then this Western scheme would come into this area and completely wipe it out because they would say these people only make a dollar a day. Mm-hmm. And they would cut down the forest. They would force people to grow sugarcane, or there was even one place in Kenya that they could be jailed if they didn't grow. And so they were basically growing for these multinational corporations. And so one, that these smallholder farmers would be taxable. So it was a big boon for the government. And you would have this incredible, basically the whole support structure ecologically, the whole agro ecosystem would collapse. You would get the springs would dry up, people would get cholera, you had a rise in diseases, you had loss of food, but then people were making more money. So you would have them, they would have like $10 a day, many of the farmers would make. Now, less people were making that money and more people were having to migrate out of the area, oftentimes going to refugee situations or they would move into the slums in the cities. And it would be written off as a success story for the World Bank who funded it, you know? And so it's such a crazy story. And I find my work in Africa is an exchange of information. I always learn more than I could possibly bring. People there are teaching me things that we need here in America even more than they would need there. And so I'm constantly bringing information back. And I believe that one of my big roles is actually dispelling the myth that everything Western ends in a glorious future. So I'm there telling people, but you know, we have a lot, we may have a lot of different things at our disposal, but ecologically that's being draining the rest of the world and it can't go on. You know, so much of the buffering of the impact of collapsing ecologies, we don't feel because we're drawing from thousands of ecologies globally, right. But the people who live within those ecologies are suffering greatly. Mm-hmm. And the Western world looks at them and says, yeah, what did they do wrong? You know, mm-hmm. And it's this really incredible judgment that comes from an just this incapacity for people to see, maybe it's not, or maybe this ignorance of people not seeing that their incredible privilege is playing out and causing so much of this around the globe. And so I think it's a really big, important time right now that we actually share stories with one another and the impacts, like seeing the tribes in the Congo who are displaced because of the tantalum mines that are, you know, feeding our electronical digital age right now. Mm-hmm. And how many of them, so many people have been killed because of it and displaced because of it. So that's one of the stories that's happening there in these places that you hear of and the that where things are collapsing. But what's so beautiful is that you have a lot of people who are saying, no, this isn't our story. We want to change the story here. We want to again, you know, our recent ancestors cut down the forest for these different reasons, but we understand that without the forest, we have no stability here, that we have no, our food is less, the water situation is worse. So how do we get the forest back? And in their cultures, a lot of different cultures, they don't have that story in their culture of how to reforest from a damaged landscape. So that's where I get invited.
Right?
yeah. So it's not in their cultural kind of playbook, you know, it's not there saying this is what you do at this situation. So I'm not coming in and saying, yeah, this is what you do culturally. They're asking me to come in to help them reforest the places that are really badly damaged. And how can we do that? And how can we do our agriculture in a way that doesn't need chemicals from Western companies and isn't causing all these ancillary effects in our water and in our health and all of these things? So it's amazing to see how many people are like, yes, this is what we need to do. And so I work with some of the largest non-government organizations in the world, working with the USAID, USAID, which is the U.S. government's aid organization. So most governments have that. Germany has GIZ. There's the Danish government has DANIDA. And I work for all of them in structuring this programming we call resilience design. And so we have a team that basically took permaculture and we snuck it into the vernacular of these larger organizations so that they would understand the potential of it at using their own language. So we basically embedded the permaculture framework into what we call the resilience design process. And that's now being picked up by organizations around the globe, like Danish Refugee Council, Mercy Corps, Save the Children, CARE, on and on, these different organizations. And so I am going over, like I'm heading to Kenya this next week and working with a Mercy Corps program, helping to grow fodder for milk production in the dry season for people in the northern parts of Kenya, the Samburu people. And they're an area that has been cut down, the forests have been cut down. And so part of the work there is to reestablish a lot of the stability of a forest in their agriculture systems. And it doesn't look like Western agriculture. It looks more like mixed forestry and agroforestry systems. Mm-hmm. And so we're drawing from the teachings of the forest to actually set up the agriculture program. And people who were recently knocked off their indigenous root get it. They're like, yes, this is what I need to do. This is what I understand from my teachings of the forest.
Mm-hmm. So when you arrive in a place like that, does it take you a while to acclimate to what the context is there, what the landscape context is there, and also the social landscape and their traditions and the stories that they do or that they have retained? You know, does it take you time to get into the cosmology of the place?
So I do a lot of research beforehand, and I'm working only with organizations that have long-term relationships with the people there. So I'm riding in on these relationships. But yes, there is a lot of observation. There's a lot of sitting with the elders and hearing the story of the land. I always do what I call the story of place, which is understanding the history of what people have been through and what how people even see their history. And then what are the things that are happening now? So what's happening in their culture now? What's happening on the land now? And then I ask the question, what do you see for the future generations? What do you see for your future, but then the future in a time beyond your own? What would you like, and what are you envisioning? And what I do and what I bring with permaculture is tools that can help them establish that from damaged landscapes. So if their landscape isn't damaged, we don't go in there. Like they're fine. Like we're not, I would never come in and say, yeah, let's do this here. No, it's only go where I'm invited. Uh-huh. I only go where I'm invited. And that's always really an important part of my ethic around this, because I don't believe in white saviorism. Like mm-hmm. I don't want to step into that, where a lot of people go into that work saying, oh, I'm going to go fix something for someone else who needs my help. It's like, I'm there gathering for my own community, which is in dire need. People in the U.S. don't realize how vulnerable they are. Mm-hmm. Maybe they do after a little bit of the things that happened with supply chains, with COVID mm-hmm. and all that. Mm-hmm. But America is one of the most vulnerable countries to collapse in the world, and they don't realize it. And mm-hmm. it has to do with the lack of knowledge of people don't know how to garden anymore. Most people don't know how to save seeds. They don't know how to process food. All these things that are a part of what it takes to be in relationship with that, which sustains us. So then we become dependent on a system that many people don't even feel good about, but they're completely dependent on it because that's how they get their food, and they don't know how to do it otherwise. And so I feel like there's a lot of lessons we can learn from our African brothers and sisters who can teach us a lot more about how to be in relationship with that which sustains us, which I think is the core to reestablishing culture in place. Because in my spiritual ecology, mm-hmm. I don't believe I believe that culture isn't in the people, it's actually in the landscape. Mm-hmm. And we are vessels of that culture expressing itself from that land through us. And mm-hmm. so when we lose our relationship to the land and that which sustains us, our cultural root gets severed. And so the beauty of that is that you can reestablish it. You can relocalize your relationship with that and start to become a vessel as a group of people in a region. Mm-hmm. We can start to reestablish cultural relationship with that place so that that land can speak through us. And I that's one of the most hopeful thoughts in my little mind that gets me through day to day, is that culture is never lost. It's just gone into hiding.
Well, I think it's very important what you mentioned about culture, because on the surface, we could say when we look at consumerist culture and how it's been imported globally around the world, or global capitalism, and we see this flattening of culture and of diversity, right? To me, it's almost like the mm-hmm. world is one enormous sort of monocrop. Like that's what's been exported around the world to live in this particular way. And just like what you're saying in Africa, that it's been imposed upon them, no, you must grow sugarcane. This is how you must be. And you must earn $10, even if you're happy at $1 and you have a more intact culture at $1, you know? So can you speak to this bringing back of the diversity and culture, as you've talked about bioregions in some of your videos?
Yeah. Well, one of my teachers, he speaks about one of the words in the Tutu Hill Mayan culture that they have. It's kind of like the Armageddon of the world. It's like that word Armageddon. It's like the world ends in a negative way. And if you translate that into English, it comes out as oneness. This idea that everything becomes one. And I think that's an interesting thing, because we often talk about oneness in a different perception. It's about interconnectivity, but it's this idea that if everything gets homogenized, the world dies a horrible death.
Right.
And one of the roles of when I'm traveling around different cultures in Africa, one of the roles of the elders is to help maintain diversity. That if they see things starting to move towards kind of reductionism and where things are getting more homogenized and they lose their diversity, their job is to rehydrate that as an elder. And I think it's an interesting concept because it's, if you look at it ecologically, as you lose the biodiversity lessens, life gets harder for everything that lives there. And you start to realize that the presence of biodiversity is an ecological principle that means abundance. And so I really believe that we need to support each other in growing in our individual gifts. Like part of the way as humans, we can support the human ecology is to recognize, like, you have a gift that has never been seen before in the history of humanity. No one has ever expressed the gifts that you carry. Right. And in all of our time on the earth, no one will ever express it but you. And in all the future humans, there will be no one else that will express your gifts that you carry. And my role as a part of your community would be to help you discover them, to nurture them and express them, and not to do what happens so much in the modern day, which is try to lump everybody together and one say, everybody needs to do this. We need standardized testing. We need, it's like all these ways to basically make everyone a good factory worker in a way, I mean, it's an interesting one way to think of it. And I really feel like one of our important goals is to help each other in finding our true nature and then expressing it in its own unique way. And then doing the same thing on our landscape, because a monoculture means you have to put a lot of toxins in to keep it alive. And if you look at that in our own life, the more our life gets simplified, the more we also start to toxify ourselves just to survive. And I find that that's an interesting parallel, that what happens in the land happens with us because we're not separate.
Exactly. You have mentioned that permaculture design is an international movement, and that it now spans some 160 countries and over 850,000 projects. Can you speak about how the movement is changing social and physical landscapes?
Yeah.
And also how the movement is feeding people.
Yeah. Those numbers are way up from there even. There are millions of people who have done that. The permaculture design, I believe millions of projects, because so many don't get documented because it just spreads out.
Right.
So, yes. The thing that I find with permaculture is that it's really geared towards community food systems. So it's not about going out and saying, we're going to replace the large monocrop systems and just do a large, here's a 3,000 acre maize farm or corn farm, and just let's do now permaculture on this. What we look at is, how do we work in a community setting as a whole? How do we integrate waste streams? How do we integrate our living shelters that are there with our income needs and all of that around nutrition and then the health of the ecology that supports it? And so it's a whole systems design based on the local agro-ecosystem that supports human settlement. And that's why I say it's a design science for human settlement. So it's a different approach. And I like to step back, because one statistic or a couple of statistics that I've seen is it takes 10 calories of energy in the industrial agriculture system to produce one calorie of food. And so you have this negative energy, but basically it's this, using this old ancient sunlight, this fossilized energy that costs so much energy to extract, to use, but it's like really high amounts of energy in this oil-based products that are driving this agricultural system, and it's basically in a trajectory to collapse. There's no way it can continue long in the future. Yeah, and that whole there's a brainwashing that I think going on where they say, oh yeah, but it's what's feeding the world. And it's not what's feeding the world. If you look statistically, the smallholder farmers are feeding more people in the world than these big industrial farmers, and always have. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I think is interesting, like in Russia, they have the dasha system, which is these small 1 to 2 acre parcel farms that mm-hmm. provide over half the food for all of Russia. So they have this incredible stability based on many, many smallholder farmers. So permaculture is around linking together many approaches within a region to build the food security of that area. And so, you know, when we go into a system of smallholder farmers like in Zimbabwe, we'll work with a farmer group there and we'll look at how we could support them in moving away from, usually there's maize, there's sorghum, there's onions, there's cabbages, there's a few major crops that they're growing mm-hmm. and that's it. And they're starving still because there's still not enough nutrition being grown, because traditionally they would have had 60 crops, wow. Anywhere from 40 to 60 crops that they would be growing to have a diversity of nutrition. So a lot of what we're doing is coming in and saying, let's get away from the annual plants that are so energy intensive, and let's integrate them in a more agroforestry based system that has stability of perennial plants that grow year after year. So tree crops that give you food and growing our fertility rather than getting into chemical dependencies with the providers of different fertilizers and biocides. And what we do is we show people how to make their own fertilizer from the natural organic materials and waste streams in their own community, and then how to work with getting really healthy plants so you don't have the infest and pest problems. And then if there are some of those problems around, that there are ways we can work with chili peppers and different plants that actually repel these pests. And so we're working only organically, we're working with smallholder farmers, but we're also influencing some of the larger farmers on how to lessen their expenses by involving nature. Because when it's, again, we started our talk off, but whenever you push against nature, it costs a lot of money. So okay. These agricultural systems that push against the natural system of wherever that is being grown are literally putting farmers into debt. And you get these smallholder farmers like in India, where suicide has become one of a major concern among farmers, because they're in this debt because they're beholden to these large multinational corporations. Basically, I feel stealing money from the smallholder farmer who can produce everything they need locally. So
it's going to take just a quick break right here, Warren, yes. And then we'll come right back.
Hey listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying Eco Justice Radio. We air every Friday at 3 p.m. on KPFK Los Angeles and every Monday at 9 a.m. on KPFT Houston. Stay connected with us. You can subscribe to Eco Justice Radio on all major podcast apps, and you can visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, to check out our previous shows, guests, share that information, get that out there, and also get connected with us on social media. Today, you are listening to A Global Perspective on Permaculture Design with host Carrie Kim and guest Warren Brush, co-founder of True Nature Designs and Quail Springs Permaculture.
You know, I wanted to shift a little bit from here to talk about water, because you've been advocating for the health of water for a long time now. Yeah. And I wonder if you would share some of your insights on the current state of water here and in the world. And, you know, I wonder, given that you have studied with Bill Mollison, you know, do the solutions remain embarrassingly simple around water?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, thank you for that question. I mean, the water is the Apache say this is the spirit that moves through all things, and it's what connects and binds us all. Like, we are mostly water ourselves. So as we, you know, our capacity to even listen to this show has to do with water, and our, you know, our bodies cycle water every 3.5 days. And it's like this system of this entity of water travels through the world. And it's such an interesting thing to think of, that, you know, all these living things are connected deeply mm-hmm. by water. And yet we have become some of the worst stewards of water in a lot of our modern day. And I in these modern times, we've looked at water as just a one as a resource, only as a resource, not actually as a living connector between all things that are alive. And I think that's changed a lot of our understanding of what it means to actually steward water and to be a tender of water. And so, like here in California, where I live, water is you know, we're in a long-term drought cycle that is being amplified by the global climate issues that are going on, the global climate change issues that are going on. But there are already historically long-term drought cycles that have affected the West here for many, many years. And one of the things I find is that you drive down the roads here, like the main highways, and you see some of these farming operations saying, don't let the politicians waste our water by dumping it in the ocean, you know, allowing the rivers to go to the ocean. Let's bring it into this agriculture. But what I find is then I look around where their agriculture is, and I don't see any rainwater harvesting structures. I don't see anything set up to actually harvest the rain that does fall.
And soil is bare half the time.
Yeah, and also using crops that are not destined for that location. So again, if you in a very dry area and you put a really, you know, like all the avocados in a lot of Southern California use huge amounts of water, and carrots are another one, use huge amounts of water. And they are crops that are not from, like the carrot is a highland temperate climate plant. The avocado is from Central America jungles. And you're replacing them in places that need high amounts of water. And that just doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense if you're trying to do the big commercial monocrop. And then amidst that, not only you have that going on, but then you're also draining your water off the land when it rains. And so there's some simple steps in the farms that we've been involved in designing. And this is one of the main things I do in my work in Africa is stabilizing the hydrology of a landscape. Mm-hmm. So looking and saying, let's not let a single drop of water, even if it's very minimal, like Quail Springs only gets 6 inches of rain a year, or 150 millimeters of rain a year. Mm-hmm. And that little bit of rain, though, is a huge amount of water. If you capture it and you put it into the soil and protect it from what I call the thieves of rain, which is the sun, wind, and the slope. And so you protect it from that so that it could be utilized over the long term. And that's why we have such good growth at Quail Springs, because we don't let the water just run off. We reestablish the hydrological stability of a forest, because forests don't allow the water to leave. The water infiltrates and then comes out through springs. And so it leaves in a natural cycle. So in all these areas, like you look around the hills of Los Angeles, and all of this area was forest. I mean, you had oak forest in the valleys, you had up further into the alpine, all forested. And so there was a really stable, you know, basically the trees were helping the water to not cause damage on that landscape and wash away and carry away all the nutrients and carry away our soils. And so what we try to do is to reestablish that stability that the forest teaches us about. And so there's a lot of different strategies that we do on very large scale, right down to a small garden in the backyard. How do you harvest rain? And so that's the first design criteria I look at when I'm walking through a land, is how would I stabilize the hydrology here so that this place would plant the rain before they plant their plants.
Yeah, it's so disturbing that when you watch the media always likes to present, of course, the doom and gloom and also disempowerment, you know, when they speak about drought, but they don't rally the masses around restoring their hydrological cycle, or even allude to the fact that water restoration is even possible. You never hear something like that.
Yeah. No. Yeah. And it's, you know, one of the things I get called the most for is to do spring line rejuvenation or borehole or well rejuvenation. So people's wells have dried up and they're like, why has it dried up? Well, you look up on the land and they've disabled the recharge capacity of that landscape. And so you rebuild that recharge capacity. And we can often bring the wells back up to a stable place if we're able to just work with the natural system of getting that water in the ground, slowing, spreading, sinking it, and then protecting it from the sun and the wind. And that is happening all over the place. And there's like, we're doing this work in countries all over the world, but I did it at our own family farm. And you can do it very easily, even in your house in the suburbs of Los Angeles. You can even use your rainwater off your roof and put them into rain gardens. And there's so much that you can do. And I think actually LA County was the first county in the country that actually now mandates that you have no runoff coming off any new construction. Everything has to go back in the ground. And I am often inspired by what some of LA County is starting to do with their processes of changing the story of being drainage engineering to retaining engineering. And I think that's, you know, if you're hearing this right now, you can stabilize your hydrology of the house you live at and the places you live at. And it's actually a really exciting story. I want to give a pitch to a book called Rainwater Harvesting for Drylands, which is by a colleague of mine, Brad Lancaster. And it's it's about designing your urban and suburban landscapes to actually, you know, get water into the ground and get really good growth going. And he based most of this off of his work in Tucson, Arizona, which is very dry.
Yeah, amazing. You know, I wanted to, you have worked a lot with youth, and I wanted to see what you would like to share with youth, because it is important for youth to hear words that I know you want to impart to them about this time and about what potentials lay before them.
For those of you young listeners and those of you who may be sharing with young listeners somewhere in your life, is that one, that the world needs to change directions and needs to pivot right now. And we need your help to guide us as well and to be a part of the process. I don't want to get to the end of my life and say, okay, now I'm going to hand off what we did. It's like, no, we need to work together now. And that there's some adults that are here right now who are saying, we know it needs to change and we're doing our best to do this. And that there are strategies to be able to do it in a way that I think will help you in understanding how much is possible in the healing process of this beautiful flowering earth that you're inheriting. And that this is something that I believe that your gifts that you carry as a young person, as they grow and prosper and bloom and evolve, that they're going to be instrumental in carrying the healing process forward. And really our work is to help support you in doing that. And ultimately, all of us are going to plant trees that we'll never sit under the shade of, that it's even going to be for a generation beyond you. And to me, that's where nobility really comes into our life. That is something we can really build our personal nobility, is by doing things for a time beyond our own. And I think we have to think like that, and we'll do it together. That's what I'd like to share.
I'm wondering, what is your own, you've talked often about what the thing that we need to ask is, what is our next best step to living more sustainably? Yeah. And I'm wondering, what is your own next best step at this point?
You know, one big one that my wife and I have been doing has been learning more about wild foods. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here in California and actually all over the earth, there's a band of latitudes that have oak trees. And I was just in Greece with my wife, and we met a woman who's started a cookie company by taking and making acorn flour, and it's saving the oak trees on the island of Kia. And we are, so my wife and I over this season and last season have been harvesting a lot of acorns and learning how to do both traditional harvesting, but then also using electric grinders and other forms of processing to actually understand how much wild foods, the vitality in wild foods. So for me, that's one of my next best steps, is actually how to look to nature's garden to harvest from that garden as part of my life, and then how to tend to that garden. So how do I, what does the oak tree love, and how can I give it what it's loves? Because isn't that truly what we do for the people we love in our life, is mm-hmm. that we learn what they love, and then we put a lot of that around them so that they're surrounded by what they love. And I want to do the same thing for the oak tree, because I love the oak trees.
We feed them. I wanted to ask you a bit about Quail Springs, and maybe briefly, if you could talk about that journey of legalizing natural building and what that journey was like. I know there's some tales in there, but we only have a couple minutes left. If you could speak a little bit about that, since that was happening here in California.
Yeah, so it's still an ongoing journey, and my hat's off to everybody. I don't live at Quail Springs anymore, but I'm very involved with them there. And even though my wife and I were founders there, we have been in a journey of trying to legalize buildings that are non-toxic and that are very low ecological footprint for 20 years now, and or almost 20 years, like 17 years now. And it's something that is, we're just eking away. Like, we just were able to get the fire standards for Cobb construction, which is earthen construction. And most people in the world live in earthen shelters. And so mm-hmm. what we've done is we've looked at it and said, let's build the evidence base that allows it to become legal even in the current system. But there's a lot of politics around the money, because right. earthen buildings are so inexpensive and you can get the materials anywhere. So a lot right. of the industries are trying to keep this from happening. So sure. we're in a journey with it. And I know Quail Springs could use a lot of help in funding the research that it's taking for this. And also the testing is incredibly expensive. So mm-hmm. trying to get each test done so that we can use this material is really important. But it's been an exciting journey as well, because it feels right. It feels right.
Well, thank you so much for that commitment, because you know, ultimately, you know, things will change. You know, it's a bit of just like you said, chipping away, and look at how far things have come already. You know, we are coming to a close now, and I wanted to see if you could share with listeners how they can stay in touch with you, how they can engage around what you're doing and contribute mm-hmm. and learn more. What are some of the links? Where can they find you?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. So quailsprings.org is the website. We have some online offerings, like basically some trainings around permaculture and how to live really ethically with the land. I'm on Instagram under Warren Brush. You can also email me at warrenbrush@mac.com. And that's the only platform I use is the Instagram. But I am often out there and sharing. You can look up YouTube and different things if you look up my name. But there are so many permaculture organizations. So just don't look up me, look up what other permaculture work is going on. And even things that aren't permaculture, look and say, who is doing things that give life? And then jump into it and learn and share and do these things to support this beautiful flowering earth for a time beyond our own.
Warren, thank you so much for your lifelong commitment and your devotion to this planet. We truly appreciate all that you're doing and all your passion and enthusiasm for this time, because we need it. We all need it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me here.
Thank you to our guest, Warren Brush, and thank you to our listeners for joining us. This has been a global perspective on permaculture design. Please connect with us on social media at Eco Justice Radio, SoCal 350, and Adventures in Waste. If you like what you heard and you want others to be informed, well, you know what to do. Subscribe to our podcast, share the episodes, and get that information out there. And also help us continue our efforts by making a donation to the show at ecojusticeradio.org. You have been listening to Eco Justice Radio on KPFK Los Angeles and KPFT Houston, a project of SoCal 350. The show can be found at kpfk.org, kpft.org, all major podcast apps, and at ecojusticeradio.org. Created by Mark and JP Morris, executive producer Jack Eit, producer and co-host Jessica Aldridge, co-host Carrie Kim, and engineer and original music by Blake Quake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.